Hey everyone, it's Jeff cutting in before the opening of theme music to let you know what you're listening to. Yeah, Beth and I decided to give ourselves a little bit of a break during the holidays by not giving ourselves a full load of episodes to record. So, but we wanted to make sure you had something to listen to every week, so we decided to re-release one of our most cherished episodes. So that's what you're about to listen to now. This is the Jeopardy episode that was originally released back in December of 2019, December 8th, to be exactly. And that was an episode that featured our very first guest, with a bit of an asterisk there. I'll explain in a minute. So our guest that episode was my friend and Jeopardy contestant Stephen Grade, and he talked about his experience on the show, and Aunt Beth and I and Stephen as well all talked about our experiences watching Jeopardy throughout the years. Oh, and that asterisk explanation. So Stephen was the first guest on a full episode, but the episode prior was a Thanksgiving check-in with family episode. So I believe my cousin Wesley was on that, or no, actually I was that one. I was like going around at Thanksgiving at my talking to my aunts and uncles and cousins and whoever was around, and just getting messages from everyone. So Stephen was the first guest who was there throughout the whole recording session, as it were. So anyway, yes, so this is the Jeopardy episode, and we picked this one out as a good one to re-release because it's arriving on your podcast feeds on January 3rd, which is the day before the final week of Alex Trebek's final episodes begin airing. His last episode that he aired, that he hosted before he passed away, is set to air on January 8th, Friday, January 8th. So we figured people would be in a mood to check out Jeopardy content. And yeah, so that's what you've got going for here. And I asked Aunt Beth and Stephen if they had any messages they wanted me to share. And Aunt Beth said she'd like me to mention that she misses Alex. She said, "I miss you, Alex," and she's finding it rather difficult to think of anyone else hosting Jeopardy. We'll find out soon how that will go. I imagine it will feel surreal for quite a while. And Stephen, he provided us with a nice long message. Here's what he had to say. "The knowledge that Alex was sick and that we'd be dealing with this sad news sooner or later didn't make it any easier to hear. I think that's because it's so hard to imagine the absence of an icon like that, someone who has been part of the fabric of our shared culture for so long. Every day for almost 40 years, millions of people would invite Alex into their homes, and every day he'd be there to entertain and educate. I've probably shared more dinners with him than anybody except maybe my parents, and I know I'm not alone in that. I don't think you can really measure the impact that Alex had. There's no telling how many people out there were inspired to pursue their love of knowledge by watching him on Jeopardy, or who learned some cool new fact that introduced them to their new favorite thing or field of study. And it goes beyond just things like facts. There was a moment on a show the week before Alex's passing where a contestant told a story about learning to speak English by watching Jeopardy with his grandfather." I believe this is me cutting in. This is me, Jeff, cutting in on Stephen's message. I believe he's referring to Bert Tacker, who won an episode that aired back in December. That was like, I think, just a couple days before Alex passed away. Now back to Stephen's message. That's the kind of effect Alex had on people. You could see it in the outpouring of support that came when he first announced his diagnosis, or after Drew's answer in the Tournament of Champions went viral, or in the tributes and memories that have been pouring out of so many people from so many walks of life as Alex's final episodes have been airing. Alex crossed barriers between people in a way that doesn't often happen these days, and I think that's the greatest tribute that could be paid to them." Oh, yeah. Lovely tribute from Stephen. Lovely tributes coming in from all corners of the world in the days since Alex passed away. And I'd like to also mention that I'm recording this intro on January 1st, and I just did an annual wrap-up that I do where I keep a dream journal and I keep track of all the times people have appeared in my dreams over the course of the year. And I was not surprised to discover that among celebrities, Alex was the highest entrant in 2019. He appeared in nine of my dreams in the past year. I have lots of Jeopardy dreams, so I imagine I'll still be seeing Alex in my dreams, even though I won't be seeing him on my TV as much as I have in the past decades. So, all right, I'll leave you to it. Either go ahead and re-listen to this episode or listen to it for the first time. And Aunt Beth and I'll be back in the coming weeks with some new episodes. We've got some plenty of entertainment cooking for you. Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of That's Entertainment. I am, as always, Jeffrey Malone, pop culture maven, and with me, of course, live from Hampton, Maine, is my Aunt Beth Woods. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
And it's a very special episode of That's Entertainment today because we have our first guest ever with us, and that is live from Atlanta, Georgia, Stephen Grade. How are you today, Stephen?
I'm doing well, Jeff. Thank you so much for having me on. I didn't realize I was your first guest. I'm even more honored than I already was.
Well, glad to hear it. I hope that that doesn't put too much pressure on you.
No, I'm used to dealing with pressure by now.
Good. As you may have guessed from the first minute or so of listening to this episode or by reading the title of the episode, our topic today is Jeopardy, and we have him on the show because he was a semifinalist in this year's Tournament of Champions. For those of you who don't know what Jeopardy is, and even for those of you who do know, here's a little information about that.
This is Jeopardy!
Amidst the wreckage of the 1950s quiz show scandals, media mogul Merv Griffin's wife, Julianne, hit upon an idea. What if we gave contestants the answers, and they had to provide the questions? This was born Jeopardy!, which premiered on NBC in 1964 with host Art Fleming. That version lasted until 1979. Then in 1984, Weird Al Yankovic released the song I Lost on Jeopardy! That same year, a daily syndicated version of Jeopardy! Premiered, hosted by Alex Trebek. Cut ahead to 35 years later, and that version is still going strong today. And that is what we will be talking about. And I already mentioned that Stephen is a Jeopardy veteran, but we also have another game show veteran here with us today. And that is Aunt Beth, who won $32,000 back in 2000, I believe, on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Oh, yes. I didn't know you were going to bring that up. Thank you.
I had no idea. Congratulations, Aunt Beth.
Thank you. I wanted to congratulate you, too. But yeah, that was back in the Regis days. It was quite exciting.
I was trying. I actually made sure I got that info correct. You are on the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire wiki. You have a page there. And just to confirm what year you are on.
I have a page.
There's
So you know Wikipedia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, individual shows have their own wikis that are just, they're like their own individual Wikipedias just about that show. So Who Wants to Be a Millionaire has, like, I guess every contestant who's ever been there indexed on it.
Okay. I'll have to look that up.
Well, since there is so much to cover about this topic, let's jump right into it. Does that sound good to the two of you?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. Well, our first section, I forgot to do the breakdown of the main premise of this show, of our podcast, that is. On each episode of That's Entertainment, we discuss a topic according to the three Fs: first, favorite, and forever. So our first section, appropriately enough, is first, in which we will be discussing our first memories of watching Jeopardy. And Aunt Beth, since you were the only one alive back when the Mark Fleming version aired, I'll let you kick it off in this section.
Since I'm the old one here. Yeah, well, I don't remember the exact date, but I know from probably close to when it started, our family watched it religiously. But that at the time, it was on during the day at noon. And so we used to come home from, I can remember walking home from school at lunchtime, and we'd watch, we'd probably miss maybe the first 5 minutes, and we'd watch Jeopardy. And then there was another game show called Who, What, and Where right after that. And we'd watch that probably till about five of, and then head it back out. And so I would have been in, that would have been about third grade for me. So my brother would have been in sixth grade. So he would have still been in elementary school too. So we would have watched it then. And then
that brother is my dad.
Jeff's dad, Bob, yes.
Right, who also appeared on Jeopardy back in 1990, I believe.
Yes, we are a very game-oriented family. So,
all are very accomplished.
Yeah. So I guess we must have only been able to watch it, you know, regularly in the summer or whenever we were home from school, or when we came home at lunch. But that was, you know, I just remember that. I also remember that we always would buy the board game edition. There were many different editions, and we played that with friends and family all the time, which was really fun. And my other memory was that Art Fleming was not very, I don't know what the word is. He was a bit rude. Like he just wasn't smooth with the contestants. You know, if they get things wrong, it was almost like he was, I don't know. None of us really liked him. It'd be fun for you guys to watch some old episodes just to check it out.
Yeah, I think some I've watched a little bit on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I think some episodes have like been lost permanently because just the tapes were like back in the 60s, networks just taped over old episodes.
Okay.
But there is some footage on YouTube, I believe.
Yeah, it would be fun to see. And that's when the questions were worth, what, 25? I think they started at 25, 50, yeah. 75, 100, and what did it go? I can't even remember, but certainly a lot less than they are today. So,
mm-hmm.
Okay, that's my memory.
Well, and then the other thing, other part of this section to ask is, so when did has it since then been a regular part of your viewing schedule?
Now it's been a lot more sporadic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't watch it like you guys every single night. I always watch the tournaments, and I'm not always home. Not that I'm out all the time, but I don't always think about it. So I used to watch it probably a lot more when I was younger. Now I haven't watched it as much.
Yeah, that's seems to be a story with a lot of Jeopardy viewers. Like, at a certain stage of their lives, they watched it every day religiously, and sometimes they go in and out. And some people,
yeah, and it's more fun to watch it with other people. Like, if I'm at, whenever I'm at your house, I like to watch it because everybody's kind of playing along. So
right,
I'd be more apt to put it on, you know, at someone else's house. But yeah, so I try to, if I think about it, I'll put it on. I know you watch it religiously.
I do. Yes. So we'll go ahead and move on to Stephen for the same question, but I also wanted to make sure I introduced you with some of your other stats. In addition to being a Tournament of Champion semifinalist, you were a 5-day winner. I believe your run started in March and went into April of this year.
Yes, I was the last week of March and the first week of April. So I had the good fortune of airing up against the Sweet 16 and the Elite Eight on a couple of my games.
Right.
So everyone had to decide if they wanted to watch me or the NCAA basketball tournament.
Oh, okay.
Luckily, my choice is watch Jeopardy, because then I'm missing the beginnings of games as opposed to the end of them. So
that's true. At least I wasn't up against a buzzer beater.
Right. And then you were also the breaker of the 4-day curse.
yes, I was.
Stretch. For where there were some 4-day winners, but it had been a while since the most recent 5-day winner. I looked it up, and I believe the last 5-day winner before you was Alan Dunn back in October of last year.
Yes, Alan put a hefty curse on the studio set before I got there. I think it was something like 5 or 6 4-day winners between the two of us. It had been something like the third longest stretch without somebody winning 5 games in a row in the 35-year history of the show with Alex Trebek as host. And I just had the good fortune of, you know, being there when I did and getting on a good run. So I've got that little note to put on my resume.
Yeah.
Yes, you do. Okay, so same question. When what are your earliest memories of watching Jeopardy? And when did it become a regular part of your viewing schedule, if in fact it did?
Oh, it did, and it's similar to Aunt Beth's story. Growing up, it was just always appointment viewing for me. In the Atlanta market, Jeopardy's always come on, at least as long as I can remember, at 7:30 in the evening. So I would sit down with my family and have dinner, and then we'd move over to the couch and we'd start yelling out answers at the television. And we did that, you know, going back as long as I can remember. Honestly, my first real memory of actually watching an episode, weirdly enough, was the Rock and Roll Jeopardy that used to air on VH1 with Jeff Probst as the host. I can remember sitting around, we had some friends over for dinner that night, and friends over to our house that day, and we were just watching, you know, kind of a marathon of it on VH1, and I'm sitting there at, you know, 10 or 12 years old or so, and getting all these questions right about bands that were popular before I was ever born, stuff that my parents didn't even know, and they were fans of these bands. And I just remember people looking at me and being like, you know, Steven, how did you know this?
Yeah.
And it was from, you know, like pop-up video on VH1, mm-hmm. or it was from those like compilation CDs that they used to have infomercials for, of, you know, the greatest 80s new wave one-hit wonders and stuff like that. And I would just see these commercials, and these things would kind of get stuck in my brain. And that was kind of the first inkling that I had that, like, I had a good memory for weird facts like that, that I could see something a time or two and it would just stick in there. And as, you know, I kept seeing more facts, you know, walking around through the world and, you know, reading more books and studying more things, like all these things just kind of kept getting notched into my brain. And I'd sit there and watch Jeopardy, and I'd I'd keep doing better and better and better as the years went by. But it all had its start, you know, just sitting on the couch from a very young age, watching it after dinner, and then, you know, figuring out that, you know, hey, I'm doing better at this than I should do. Maybe this is something I should, you know, entertain doing one of these days.
Yeah. Wow.
Right.
It is interesting how people, certain people seem to be able to hold that trivia. Well, it's not always trivia. I mean, it's knowledge, but keep that in their brains better than other people.
It is. And it's funny that you said that, Beth. That's something that they tell us when we get there, that they don't view Jeopardy as a trivia game. They view it as a knowledge game because they feel like they're testing you, you know, for the most part on, you know, facts, on canonical things,
yeah,
like history,
yeah,
and classical music. You know, there'll be some current popular culture or some, you know, things like wordplay categories where they're just kind of having fun with it. But for the most part, they really try to stick to, you know, like the academic categories.
Yeah.
But yeah, some folks just have that brain where, you know, something can get lodged in there and they've got a little neuron in their head that is, you know, the exclusive property of this random fact
that's
all once. And, you know,
it's forever.
Yeah, exactly, and it's just there. It's a part of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I did. You kind of made me think of something when you were talking about knowing all the band facts of bands that were before your time, which makes sense to me because I think our generation, millennial generation, people born in the 80s and 90s, were the first generation to really have an eclectic form of pop culture where the movies, TV, and music that had been around in the decades before we were born was starting to become more easily accessible, as opposed to just going away and not really being heard from again.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'd never really thought of it that way, but we had, you know, MTV and we had VH1 and we had Blockbuster Video and we've got all these different ways that, you know, we can, you know, HBO or whatever other movie channels you subscribe to. We've got all of these ways that we could access the pop culture that, you know, previous generations that our parents had, you know, grown up loving. I was fortunate enough that my dad and my mom made a point to kind of expose me to stuff that was part of an earlier generation. You know, when I was like riding in the car with them, we would listen to classic rock radio or different classic rock live albums that my dad had. They would take me to the Fox Theater here in Atlanta to see different musicals or plays that were coming through town. They both, you know, loved movies. They raised me on the classics. They encouraged me to, you know, go out and explore things that I was interested in. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we had that option where previous, the pop culture of an earlier time could be our pop culture too.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Yeah. Cause I guess I didn't have that. I mean, the earliest thing I remember in 1972, they started an oldies station, which sounds so funny, but out of New York City, and they started playing a few songs from the 60s, which, you know, I wouldn't probably know better from hearing them in the 70s than in the 60s, but we didn't have, yeah, what you guys are really exposed to all that now. I didn't have that.
Well, now the oldies stations are playing songs from the 70s and 80s.
Yes, sorry. They're old. Stephen, when did you try out for Jeopardy?
I had my first and I guess only in-person audition in May of 2018.
Okay.
I'd started taking the online test once they launched the online test, so I'd probably taken it, I don't know, 5 or 6 times, you know, kind of on a whim, just thinking it was something fun to do, and if I end up getting a call back, great, and if not, no harm done. You know, I got to spend the half an hour doing 50 Jeopardy questions.
Yeah.
But with, you know, the ability for maybe if I get lucky, something pretty cool to come from it. And I took it, you know, those 5 or 6 different times, never heard back, never really thought much of it. And then I took the, it was either late 2017 or early 2018, took it again and finally got a call back. And that was kind of the start of this,
wow,
year of trivia that I'm just now wrapping up.
That's exciting.
I'll go ahead and provide my answer to this section, which certainly is a similar in origin story to the two of you, which is like the adults in my house had Jeopardy on. It was aired at 7 o'clock, still does at 7 o'clock in the Philadelphia area. And my dad was a devoted Jeopardy watcher, as was his mom, who's also Aunt Beth's mom, my nanny Ellie. And I'd say she was probably the biggest Jeopardy fan in our family. It was understood that you did not call her between 7 and 7:30.
That's right. She did love it, yeah.
And so as long as I was home at 7 o'clock, Jeopardy was unquestionably on. And as soon as I was old enough to have some TV remote responsibilities, I would be the one turning it on if that fell to me. And WPVI, which is the Philadelphia ABC affiliate, you used to be able to get that on FM radio. So if I happened to be in the car at 7 o'clock on some weekday, I would listen to it there. But then eventually, around, I want to say in 2012, my family finally got our first DVR. And at that point, well, that guaranteed that I would never be able to miss an episode. If I were out, and even if I were out until 1 a.m., I would just turn on Jeopardy once I got home in that case.
Yeah. So you never miss it.
Exactly. And yeah, so I guess we'll go ahead and move on to the next section, which is the favorite section, where we'll discuss our favorite contestants of all time. And I guess we'll go ahead and keep the same order. So Aunt Beth, who are your one or two favorite contestants?
Well, it's hard because, like I said, I hadn't been watching it as religiously. And, you know, I started when there were some exciting times back when Ken Jennings was on. I remember then I watched it every night. And then back when James was on. And I really did like James a lot. He was a little quirky, but I found that once he lost, I really was missing him and was not watching it as much. So I guess he probably is one of my favorites. And then Stephen Grade, I put him. I enjoyed
Well, thank you very much.
And then just because of this most recent tournament, I think everybody kind of fell in love with Dhruv because he was just a sweetheart. So, but yeah, I'm not going back very far. So those were, I guess I'm sticking to James for favorite contestant.
Okay. I'll be sure to tell him that you said so.
Okay. Are you in touch with him?
Yeah, we all of us in the Tournament of Champions have a group chat that we're in on Facebook.
Oh, nice.
Messenger, and it is constantly hopping. We are always, you know, just chatting right along or posting jokes.
That's great.
Making sure that we have a way to stay in touch, even though we've already filmed the tournament.
Oh, that's wonderful. So, and then, well, you had also asked about like favorite moment or saddest moment, and I don't know if you want to first do that after or...
You can go ahead if...
Well, same as far as...
Yeah, something.
Being recent, and speaking of Dhruv, was when he... I mean, before that went viral, you know, when his question... I don't even remember what the final Jeopardy was, but he had no idea, and he wrote down, "What is We Love You, Alex?"
Dhruv, you're smiling. I like that. Let's take a look at your response. Did you come up with the right one? No? What is We Love You, Alex? That's very kind of you. Thank you. costs you $19.95. You're left with $5. Okay.
And right. When we were watching that, and Alex got so choked up, that was quite a moment, I thought. And then the saddest moment, which I guess they talk about as one of the saddest moments in Jeopardy history, was the kids tournament. Do you guys remember? It was the Thomas Hurley, the answer was the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
And he spelled it, I think he spelled it Emancipation.
Right.
And, and so they didn't accept it. And oh my, it just made me so upset for him. And it also brought up the question to me, like, are they very consistent with that as far as spelling errors? Because I feel like I feel like times that I've seen it that they have accepted things that aren't spelled correctly, or there are, you know, sometimes people don't pronounce things right, sometimes they do. So I don't know how consistent they are with that, but I just felt really bad for that kid. I mean, it actually wasn't, I think he put in one extra letter or something. It wasn't spelled that off. So I don't know what you guys think about that as far as how, you know, strict they are with spelling and pronunciation and things like that.
The way that they try to do it on those is as long as you don't add an extra syllable. So if you mix up a couple of letters, or if you spell it phonetically, they'll try to be lenient on that. But if your misspelling changes the pronunciation of the word, then that's when they'll get you. So, but I remember that episode, and the way they explained it afterwards was because he added that extra T, that changed it from emancipation to emancipation. And because there was that extra letter or two in there, it made the word not what the word was supposed to be. So it can be harsh in situations like that.
Yeah.
But they at least aim to be consistent with, you know, they'll allow for a misspelling. I think in one of my games in the Tournament of Champions, somebody misspelled a word in Final Jeopardy, but because it could still, if you pronounced it the way they wrote it, it didn't change the pronunciation of the word, they accepted it.
Interesting. Okay.
Did the producers run through those rules at the start of the game to you guys?
They do. They when you get there to start taping, there's probably an hour to an hour and a half of orientation before you even get out on the set to start rehearsal. That is all going over the rules, going over the procedures, going over how the buzzer works, going over how Final Jeopardy works, all of that. And one of the things, you know, there's plenty of time to ask questions if you need more detail, but one of the things they go over is spelling and pronunciation. So they try to make it clear going in, you know, here's what we'll accept and here's what we won't, because at commercial breaks, you can, you know, you can challenge an answer if you thought you were ruled incorrect when your answer was actually correct. You know, just the other night, there were four times when the judges reversed a ruling.
Yeah, I did see that night.
Yeah, some of those might have been that the judges caught themselves, which will sometimes happen. But sometimes if you think that they made a mistake, you can ask them to review it or see if there's an acceptable alternate answer at a commercial break. But when it comes to Final Jeopardy, that it's not as easy because once the game's over, the game's over. They can't go back and start things up again. You know, on a rare occasion, you'll see somebody get invited back who lost in a game because they were adversely affected by an incorrect ruling.
Wow.
But for the most part, you know, Final Jeopardy is going to be what Final Jeopardy is, and there's not much of a chance to get them to overturn a ruling.
Yeah.
So that's why they try to make it very clear, you know, if you have to spell it phonetically, but just know that if you add an extra syllable or an extra letter, it could end up ruling you wrong. I mean, I almost did that on one of my Final Jeopardies. I had to scribble something out because I wasn't sure if I was spelling it right, and I didn't want to risk having added an extra letter or transposed a letter that would change an answer just by mistake. So I just, instead of going by first name, last name, I just scratched it out and went last name only just to avoid, you know, the chance of me making a mistake that would cost me, you know, tens of thousands of dollars.
Well, yeah, wow. That would not be good.
No.
Okay. Yeah, so, Beth, unless you had any more.
Nope, that was I was done with that. So.
Okay, then we'll move on to Stephen and his favorite thoughts.
Yeah, well, I mean, my favorite contestants have been the ones that kind of change the way that the game is played. So mm-hmm. if you're talking about people who kind of upend what Jeopardy is expected to be, that goes back to Chuck Forrest. He was the one who did what's called the Forrest Bounce, which is what, you know, you saw all of us doing in the Tournament of Champions, what everybody was doing in the All-Star Games earlier this year, which is bouncing from category to category instead of just playing all the way through one category at a time, as a way to try and keep your opponents off balance, to give yourself a little bit of an extra advantage, and ideally to find the daily doubles before anybody else can.
Was he the first one to do that?
Yeah, he was. I don't know if he was the very first, but he was the one who was successful with it and kind of popularized it.
And when was that?
Let me pull up when Chuck was.
I think he was season two.
Oh, wow.
It's been a while since Chuck was on. Chuck was, 1985.
Oh, okay. Long time ago.
So he won five games, which was the max that you could win back then.
Right. Yeah.
And he set the all-time cash records 2 days in a row. Which, you know, I guess was easier to do since it was back in season two, but he was the one that kind of, he was the one that strategy got named after.
Okay.
So it helps you to confuse your opponents because they expect you to stay in one category and you're going to a different one. If you've been practicing for it, your brain might be a little bit more nimble, a little bit more able to go from category to category quickly, whereas it might take somebody else an extra second or two to adjust to it, which can be a huge, huge advantage when it comes down to hundredths of a second on the buzzer. So he's kind of the progenitor of James, of Arthur Chu, of Austin Rogers, of all of us. I mean, I did it in my games, of all of us who are trying to play the game a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always fun. It's, you know, watching since we taped the Tournament of Champions has been a very different experience for me because I was out there, you know, basically playing on the Jeopardy Autobahn, you know, everybody going very, very quickly, going from category to category, bouncing around, looking for daily doubles. And now it's kind of like I'm driving in a school zone. Just isn't to say that it's easier, but it's just very, very different from what I've been, you know, training myself to do and what I was, you know, watching old episodes. I was watching James's episodes. I was watching the All-Star Games. I just wanted to get in that mindset of having to go back and forth from category to category. And in a weird way, it's kind of jarring for me now watching and seeing people kind of playing the traditional Jeopardy way. It's not that it's better or worse, but I'd gotten myself so used to doing the Forrest Bounce and to kind of living with that in my head for 7 months while I was studying that it's taken me a minute to readjust here now that I'm just a fan again. But yeah, Chuck was the one that did that. You know, I mentioned, you know, I loved watching Arthur's games. I know that he was kind of controversial amongst the Jeopardy fan base, but he was taking that strategy, that hunt for daily double, that go back and forth from category to category, really making some hay with it. Roger Craig, was a fantastic player. You know, if we're talking about favorite moments, his, back-to-back true daily doubles in the Tournament of Champions finals, where he quadrupled his score and essentially put the tournament away in two questions is just kind of one of the most, you know, wow, I can't believe that you had the guts to go through with that moments that I can remember seeing on the show, especially in that situation.
When was what year was that tournament?
I believe Roger was 2011. Yes, 2011 was that tournament.
Novels 1200.
Answer. Daily double. You have a $1,600 lead over Tom.
I'll bet it all.
Oh, all right. Here is the clue for you in novels. Her Agnes Gray appeared in 1847 under the pseudonym Acton Bell. Note the initials.
Who is Anne Bronte?
Anne Bronte, the least known of the three Bronte sisters. 18,000, your new total.
Languages, 1,600.
The other daily double is there.
I'll bet it all.
All right, here is the clue. Although Dutch is the official language, Tranantongo is spoken by most people in this South American country.
What is Suriname?
Suriname is right. $36,000. Oh boy. Making it really tough for Tom and Buddy.
That one was on Netflix here recently, actually, while I was studying for the Tournament of Champions. So I watched that tournament the whole way through, and I made sure to rewind that part a couple of times just so I could, you know, bask in the glory of such an amazing, amazing move.
Wow.
But
a lot of Jeopardy viewers listed their favorite moments.
Oh, for sure. Just because, you know, like, he was so calm about it. He was so cool. Like, if you watch it, he almost looks like excited that he gets to do it. And then, of course, that led to the hysterical moment in the Battle of the Decades a few years later, where he was up against Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter and found a daily double. And you can hear one of them lean over to him and go, "Bet it all," just kind of like, you know, joking around with him. And then he actually did it. I believe he got that daily double wrong, but it was just funny to see that his "I'll bet it all" moment has had become so ingrained that even, you know, players the level of Ken and Brad were kind of ribbing him about it. But yeah, those were always the players that I found myself drawn to, were the ones that were willing to try something a little different. You know, you'll sometimes see players who do that and maybe they don't have the knowledge to back it up, or maybe they're up against somebody who can do it just as well as they can and it doesn't always work out. But when you get that perfect combination of a player who's quick on the buzzer, who's prepared to play the game a little bit differently, and they're able to catch folks off guard, they can make for some really, really entertaining games.
Yeah. All right. Before I get into my favorites, Stephen, did you have any other thoughts about your favorites?
Any other favorite stuff? Let me see. I pulled up a couple of things here. Oh, well, if you're going for a comedy moments on Jeopardy, it's hard to beat Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Uh-huh.
Not exactly the guy you expect when you think of, something amusing to happen on a game show. But Kareem messing up his own quote from Airplane and confusing G-rated movies for X-rated movies. That's pretty tough to top. Kareem's a Hall of Famer, but he's a Jeopardy Hall of Famer for a very, very different reason.
Well, I think there was also another moment with Kareem where there was a clue about this UCLA basketball player. And I think Kareem just, and on Celebrity Jeopardy, they'll have some very easy clues thrown in there. And, but not like,
not your own name.
I think he saw a UCLA basketball player and then didn't read the rest of the clue. So he rings in, says, "Who is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar?" I believe the actual answer was
Bill
it?
Bill Walton.
That's right. Yeah. It was Bill Walton. Which Kareem should have known easily if he had just been paying attention for the rest of the clue.
Yep.
I went to UCLA for $400. You're going to love it. Tell your old man to drag this 70s UCLA and Trailblazer center and Lanier up and down the court for 48 minutes. Kareem?
Who is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar?
No! You're the one who delivered the line, but it was about Bill Walton.
Oh!
Embarrassing moments on Jeopardy! Pick again, though, Kareem. You're in command of the board.
I went to UCLA almost.
Yes, all right.
But that'll get you. I mean, there was one category in the Tournament of Champions last month that was all about, like, keywords that are usually associated on Jeopardy with a certain answer, but they were a different answer. And that one was diabolical. If I had gotten that in one of my games, I'd have been in huge trouble because I spent all of my time studying those Jeopardy keywords, those Pavlovs, we call them. So that when I see something like March King, I think John Philip Sousa, and I stop reading instead of reading the rest of the clue to see that it's Edward Elgar. Or Duke of Braintree being John Adams instead of John Hancock. So I can completely understand Kareem seeing UCLA center and being, "Hey, that's me." Because they caught me the same way.
All right. Well, I'll go ahead and add my thoughts to my favorites. And yeah, I'll have to second Stephen, your sentiment towards players who revolutionized the game. What I did in coming up with my favorites, I sort of split it in between what I favored when I was younger and what I favored since entering my 20s or so. And I'd say when I was young in the 90s, what I mainly favored in a Jeopardy contestant was a unique personality. And in a game like Jeopardy, where you mostly have introverted nerds as your contestant, anyone, and I do mean that with plenty of fondness.
Yes, it's a compliment.
Right. But if you show any sort of personality, it sticks out. And it certainly stuck out in the case of Bob Harris, who won 5 games back in 1997, was a finalist in the 98 Tournament of Champions. He was this balding fellow, usually stood hunched over. But like if he got a few questions wrong, but then followed it up with a $1,000 clue that got him back into the game, he would cheer and get the audience into it, you know, much more so than just about any contestant ever would. And then he went on to write a memoir entitled Prisoner of Trebekistan.
Yes.
Which is kind of about what was going on in his life as he was preparing for Jeopardy, and then what it was like being on the show and how his life changed once he became a Jeopardy champion. So yeah, those were the type of players I really admired in my younger days. And I would say it was around the time I was in college and right out of college when I was really, really became a big booster for the Disruptors. So it was the perfect time for me to see Roger Craig in 2011, a year after I graduated college. And in his second game, he won $77,000, which at the time, in the pre-James Holzhauer era, was the highest one-day total of all time. And yeah, I mean, Stephen, as you've already said, his strategy of bouncing around the board, fishing for daily doubles, betting as big as possible, really showed me and anyone else watching how much you can maximize your Jeopardy winnings in, you know, just a half an hour.
Yeah. And,
you know, he wasn't the first to employ those strategies, but I think he was the one who sort of harmonized them better than anyone else up to that point.
Yeah, as this year has shown us, there's, you know, if you employ those strategies the right way, there's definitely a way to use them the right way, and there's definitely a way to, you know, maximize, you know, the potential of these, you know, 22 to 24 minutes that you've got. There's a lot of money out there to be made, and it's just a matter of kind of being confident enough and willing to take those risks, and you can make them pay off in an enormous, enormous way.
That you can. And well, getting back to the comedy. So I was going to mention as my all-time favorite moment, Roger's double daily double, but Stephen, you already got to that. So one other moment I wanted to mention, which I think is a little more obscure, but it's really stuck with me. It was, I think I'm getting this contestant correct. It was Warren Usui or Usui. His last name is spelled Usui. I was a Japanese American fellow who won 3 games back in 2003. He's a bit of an oddball. During the contestant interviews, the contestant before him was telling a story about how he and his wife adopted a stray dog, and then after a few weeks, they realized it was actually a coyote. that got a laugh from the audience. Then Alex is walking over to Warren for him to tell his story. But before Alex can introduce that, Warren said, "We found out our dog was a rhino." And Alex, one of the few times where Alex had no idea how to respond to what a contestant just said.
Oh, that's funny.
I was watching, I saw this pop back up on my Twitter feed a few days ago. It was a contestant who told a story. She was in the middle podium, and she told a story about a pet goat that she had that ate a box, that ate a bag of Quikrete. The story made Alex laugh so hard that he wasn't even able to get to the third interview. He just walked right past the third person and went back to his podium. If you can get a good, genuine laugh out of Alex when you're telling a story, that's worth, you know, 5 wins right there. I got a good laugh out of Alex after one of my stories, and that's going to be my best memory out of being on the show. It's not going to be the money. It's not going to be the tournament. It's going to be like, I made Alex Trebek actually laugh at one of my stories. Like, what was your achievement?
What was the story?
I think that was the story about me almost bumping, knocking over Hank Aaron my first day on the job working for the Atlanta Braves.
I read that.
He kind of kept pressing me on it, and I had a couple of just like a little witty repartee with Alex, and I managed to get him to, you know, crack a smile and throw me a chuckle. It's not every day you hear a story about almost, you know, knocking Hank Aaron over as you're exiting the bathroom at work. So I guess that just the ridiculous of the situation helped me to stand out a little bit.
Yeah.
He's into sports and almost knocked down Hank Aaron.
So as I was running down the hall to get to the bathroom, his door came open and I had to almost slide into second base to avoid knocking over the home run king.
Everything worked out.
Worked out great. He's still spry.
All right. Well, I think before we move on to the final section, the forever section, Aunt Beth, you and I came up with a trivia question for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen, you can feel free to participate in these as well.
Yeah, for sure.
So if you're ready, Aunt Beth, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I actually did a couple, but I guess the best one is, do you know what the most common category is on Jeopardy?
Does it have a specific name? Like, it's not like just like broadly geography or history?
No, it has a name, and it says it's reappeared 114 times.
Okay. I'm going to guess potpourri.
No. Steven, do you have a guess?
I'll take a shot. Is it word origins?
No. See, I would have no idea either. It's before and after.
Okay.
Yeah. Those are, I'm usually not very good at the wordplay categories, but I really do like before and after and before, during and after.
Yeah. I like those. You have to be quick on those though, really thinking. And then I just found this interesting. They said, I don't know if you know this. If you've competed on Jeopardy, you cannot compete on Wheel of Fortune or vice versa. That was a trivia thing listed because they're considered like sister shows or something.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, they're filmed next to each other on the Sony lot. They share staff. They share producers. We did some of our promo work out on the Wheel of Fortune stage while we were out there for the Tournament of Champions. Yeah, they're pretty closely linked.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was mine. How about yours, Jeff?
Okay. So this is going to test your memory a bit. Back in July of 2018, you were vacationing in Pennsylvania. You're staying at my parents' house.
Uh-huh.
And that Friday the 13th, you, me, and my dad watched Jeopardy together. And there was a rather strange occurrence on Final Jeopardy. A contestant named Vincent Valenzuela provided a an answer that we could not understand.
Yes.
So I'm going to read you that the final Jeopardy clue from that day.
Okay. And
see if you can remember what Vincent's incorrect answer was.
Okay.
And what the actual correct answer was, which he had initially written but then crossed out.
Okay.
So the category was modern language, and the clue was, this slang term for an environmentalist is literally true of groups that used passive resistance versus deforestation, as in India in 1973.
So is the real answer tree hugger?
Right. That was the correct answer.
I remember the instance exactly because the three of us looked at each other like, what is he talking about? But I can't remember what he wrote. Oh, God, that it was so weird. You'll have to tell me. I can't
I'll
remember.
Give you a hint.
I do remember what he wrote.
You remember?
I remember this incident. I do. But Jeff, you go ahead and give a hint. I don't want to play spoiler.
Okay. So the monitor was slightly cut off. So while Alex read the clue correctly, or read it as it was supposed to be, by saying this slang term, the monitor cut off the T, so it said his slang term.
Oh, so that's what he saw?
Right, so he wrote down a person's name.
It wasn't like the Dalai Lama or something, was it?
No.
Okay, I can't remember.
Steven, do you think you know it?
I do, because this is a name that came up a bunch in my studying for the tournament champions. He wrote down Carl Sagan.
That's correct.
And that's one of those instances that I mentioned where Vincent was actually invited back later that year because because there was a mistake on Final Jeopardy, and they knew that he didn't get it wrong because of something he did. He got it wrong because of a problem on the show side. Yeah. So they had him come back later on in the year and give him another chance to play again since he was disadvantaged.
Did anybody else read it incorrectly, though?
I don't believe so. I believe the other two contestants both got it right. They went by what they heard Alex say. And maybe their vision just... Maybe they didn't see how it was appearing on the monitor. Maybe they just like filled in that T because they knew they heard Alex say it, and that's what made the most sense to hear.
That's something they tell us in orientation is that sometimes there is a technical problem that maybe you're supposed to see a video and you can't. Maybe you're supposed to see a picture and you can't. Maybe there's a word cut off, but if you listen to what Alex says and you can piece it out that way, go ahead and ring in. That was something that happened last week, I think, that a picture of Tom Hanks came up, but the signal lights that tell you you're allowed to buzz in never came on. So everybody just sat there waiting for them, and no one got it right because they waited too long. So everybody watching at home is like, how do these three people not know who Tom Hanks is?
Yeah.
Well, the answer is there was a problem with the show, not with them. But nobody thought to just, you know, give it a try and try to buzz in just in case there had been a problem.
Yeah. How did you know, Jeff, that when did you find out that he was reading the monitor wrong?
I think they explained it on the episode that he was invited back on.
Oh, okay. I
think they might have said something at the end of that episode. Like there was a little talking head with Alex that they had filmed afterwards. And then they mentioned it again when Vincent came back, just to say like, hey, for those of you at home who saw, you know, that this may have looked incorrect, here's what happened. We're going to invite Vincent back later on this season.
Oh, okay. I think they posted that on the Jeopardy website.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, because I remember they had shown it at the end of the episode. We wouldn't have been confused, but I know we were puzzling over it for...
I remember seeing something that was like Alex kind of walking us through it, but you're right, that might have been the website or YouTube or something like that.
Okay, so let's move on to the final section, the forever section, where we provide our current thoughts on today's topic. So we're going to go ahead and focus on the most recent Tournament of Champions, which were held this past November, which Steven competed on, made it to the semifinals, where he went up against the eventual champion, James Holzhauer, who won, is it 33 games in his original run?
He either won 32 and lost in 33, or won 33 and lost in 34.
I think it was 132. Let's look it up quick.
For the sake 32. Of accuracy.
I wrote down 32 from somewhere. Okay.
Yes, he won 32.
Okay. Yes, so that's the second most regular games won all time. Second only to Ken Jennings, and his total winnings of over $2 million is also second to only Ken Jennings, and he holds the record for single game winnings. In fact, I believe he holds the 13 highest totals.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. But anyway, we're not here to talk just about James. We're here to talk about all the contestants on this year's Tournament of Champions. And I'd have to say, this was a great tournament. And I think this entire decade has been spoiled with great tournaments of champions. I don't know if that's recency bias, I mean, just remembering them more. But I think we've had had winners who are great all-time champions, and they didn't become the champions easily. They had some strong competition along the way. What would you guys say about that?
You go first, Steven, because I didn't have a lot on this to contribute, actually, since I haven't been watching as much lately. So,
yeah, no problem. I couldn't agree more, Jeff. You know, when you look at the caliber of player and the folks that have, you know, made the semifinals and finals, and how the questions get so much more difficult, and the scores that some folks are still able to put up despite that, the tournament really is just another level of competition. And I think that the past few in particular have been especially strong. I mean, I don't want to brag, but I honestly think that ours was possibly the best Tournament of Champions that they've ever put on. Just if you look at how kind of obscure and esoteric some of those boards were, and, you know, Emma putting up the second highest final score of all time and still only coming in second, you know, the number of correct daily doubles, the number of correct final Jeopardies, and then you add in the fact that, you know, we're not playing top down, we're, you know, upping the difficulty for ourselves by bouncing around and by hunting for daily doubles the way that we were. There was a lot going on, and still you saw some really, really strong scores all throughout the tournament, but especially, you know, James and Emma going back and forth at it in that finals. But even still, you know, Emma, you know, she had a really, really tough challenge from Kyle in her semifinal match. Francoise came down to Final Jeopardy. All three of them were still in it. You know, James had a runaway on me, but there was one question that if I had gotten right, ours would have come down to Final Jeopardy as well. So they were all really, really close matches, really, really close games throughout, just lots of fun to watch, lots of fun to be a part of. And from what I was reading, folks thinking it was some pretty challenging material that we were covering. I know that I'm biased, but I think that we put on a great, great show with some pretty difficult categories.
Yeah. No, it was really fun to watch. It really was.
But even if you look back to the previous Tournament of Champions, you know, Buzzy and Austin and Alan, like, they did a fantastic job. You know, Roger Craig, Alex Jacob, Ben Ingram, like, we've had some really, really, you know, I mean, Ben Ingram coming out of nowhere to beat Julia Collins, who won 20 games, and Arthur Chu, who people were, you know, he was kind of the proto-James, people saying that he broke the game, Jeopardy will never be the same after people see the way that Arthur plays. And, you know, I mean, Ben wasn't a shabby player in his own at all. I think he won 8 or 9 regular season games, but everybody was just overlooking him in the finals. And he comes along and he's like, no, I can hang with these two, you know, all-time greats. And he absolutely did. I mean, there's the Tournament of Champions. Alex said it at the top of the tournament this year. It's always, you know, a great show. It's always highly anticipated. And you know, there's a reason for that. Like you can just tell that it's a different caliber of play.
Yeah. So I have a question. And it's only once a year, right? The Tournament of Champions.
There's no set time. It usually falls about once every 2 years. Prior to ours, the most recent one had been November of 2017.
Oh, okay. And so they pick the top 15, is it?
Yeah, it's 15 people. Generally, they go by how many games you won is the first thing they use to rank them. And then if you won the same number of games, how much money you won.
Okay.
So we had, you know, there were some 4-game winners that didn't get in because the 4-game winners who qualified had won more money than they did.
Okay. So some don't. That's what I was curious. So not everybody's always going to make it then.
Correct.
Yeah, typically, traditionally, if you won at least 5 games, then you're guaranteed entry. So, like, if it gets to a certain point where, like, if you somehow have a streak of 15 5-game winners over just the course of, let's see, how many weeks would that be required to take? That would be 15 weeks, so 4 months. Yeah, if you somehow had 15 5-game winners over the course of 5 months, they'd be like, they might decide, okay, we'll have the next Tournament of Champions as soon as possible.
So, okay, yeah, because I was going to say, so if there were more than 15 5-day champions, they'd have to do it the tournament before got to be that many more.
Yes, and there was one tournament, I think, where they had too many 5-game winners, and they just held 2 of them over for the next tournament.
Okay.
But it generally, you know, that I think has only happened once in the show's history. Usually it takes them about 2 years to get what they feel is, you know, a full complement. Gives you a couple of teachers tournament winners, which gets you automatic entry, gives you a college champion winner, which gets you automatic entry. And then, you know, 4- and 5-game winners, they don't come along that often, especially ours. We had that big, huge drought of between five winners. But even still, it takes a while to get, you know, to get a good compliment, a solid number up in there.
Yeah. Okay. And Jeff, what were you, did I interrupt you on your thoughts of the?
One thing it sparked with me when, Stephen was talking was, I think, you know, James ended up winning the tournament and I think most viewers figured he was the favorite and I would say he was just as strong as he was during his original run, but it really was clear that if just one or two clues had gone differently, that it could have been a different result. Like, it came down to Final Jeopardy in the second day of the final. If James had gotten it wrong, then Emma would have won. James had missed earlier in the tournament, like on the semifinal when you played against him, Stephen. Uh-huh. He did not know final. And how close was that? I don't think you were too far off from being within half of his total.
I think I was about 4,000 off.
Okay.
And I had missed it, and I had missed a $2,000 clue earlier in the game. So if I get that one right, and it happened that he had gotten that one right and then found a daily double with the next choice, so that was a $6,000 swing plus, I think, $9,000 that he got from the daily double. So that was a $15,000 swing right there. So it really came down to that one clue at the beginning of Double Jeopardy. But even if I had just kind of stayed quiet and not buzzed in on that one, I would have had a chance at, you know, making it not a runaway going into final.
Wow. Yeah. If I remember correctly, did you attempt an answer on final, or did you just write a message?
No, I just wrote a message. I had wanted to do that my first time around, but I kind of chickened out at the last second. I just wanted to write something to the folks at the show thanking them for having me out. And I knew going into the tournament that if there was a situation where I was going to bet nothing in Final Jeopardy, that I was going to write something to them. So I didn't really spend time thinking about if I could get that Final Jeopardy question right. Just glancing at it, I narrowed it down to you needed to write two answers, and I narrowed it down to three. So I would have had, I guess, a 50-50 shot of just, you know, writing one down and then picking the other one. But, you know, that's one thing that I don't have to lose sleep over now. I don't need to worry, oh, I know I would have gotten it right. Like, I can say I maybe would have gotten it right. I maybe wouldn't have. I really don't know. And I'm okay with that. But I mean, that just, like what you said, Jeff, that just goes to speak to, you know, the quality of the competition. I mean, James was as on as he was in any of his other matches. And even with that, you know, you didn't see him getting $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 in a game. Like, people were able to keep it, you know, to the point where it, like, he just couldn't rack up those big totals where there were games that were in doubt going into Final Jeopardy. You know, he missed that Final Jeopardy. He missed a couple of daily doubles in the finals. The level of competition goes up. The questions are going to be harder. It's going to be tougher on all of us. And even still, there were folks that were hanging right in there with him.
Yeah.
I want to take it back a bit, because for, don't know how many people realize this, but James's first game was the day after your last game.
Yes, it was. We were ships passing in the night.
Oh, wow. Back in April?
Did you meet him at all?
Yeah, we were, you know, we met each other in the lobby of the hotel that day. We were in the green room together during orientation. We did rehearsal together. And then after that, I was out there on stage while he was up in the stands. So once I got going, you know, for my second day of taping, I didn't really have a chance to see much of anybody other than the folks who were out there on stage with me.
So after, I believe your last game was on a Tuesday, I think.
My last game was a Wednesday, okay. And then James started on that Thursday game.
So, usually, I have this correct, a week's worth of games are filmed over the course of one day.
Yes, we do the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday games in the morning. Then we have a break for lunch and then come back and tape the Thursday, Friday games. So I was out there taping on a Monday and a Tuesday, I believe. Yes, I started the day after the Super Bowl. So I taped one game and then had lunch and then taped two more on that Monday and then came back Tuesday morning and taped three more right in a row.
Wow.
And then did you have the option of sticking around and watching the other two games that were shot that day?
They'll allow you to if you want to. At that point, I was just so mentally and physically exhausted that I just wanted to grab some lunch and lay down in my hotel room. Because it's, you know, you really don't get, it's really, really different being out there. It's not just being on set and, you know, having the lights on you and being there, you know, standing in place for, you know, hours at a time while you're playing Jeopardy. But it's that you're playing three games of Jeopardy right in a row with, you know, maybe a 5-minute break between them. That's not something that I had ever done before. I had never, you know, recorded episodes and watched them all in a row just to kind of prepare myself for, you know, what if I win three games or four games or five games? But boy, it does a number on your brain. I mean, by the time I was in my last game, I don't know if I could have strung a complete sentence together, let alone kept on playing any Jeopardy.
That's a lot. Wow.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's a marathon. Like, it is a mental marathon and a physical one too. You know, it's not easy standing up for, you know, 3 hours in one place, not moving around, you know, being on your feet, wearing dress shoes, which I don't like doing. I find them very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, having to be so sharp on the buzzer, have such quick reactions. I mean, it's a mental game for sure, but it's also a surprisingly physical one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that leads me into my another question I wanted to ask, which was after your initial run, so you won five games, you can be pretty sure that you're going to be in the TOC after that. When did you become aware of James's run? How did that affect your strategy leading into the TOC? And would you have adjusted your strategy in the same way or a similar way anyway?
I got wind of James's run. Like, they had started airing promos about the next Great Jeopardy champion, with, you know, just like quick shots of people's faces.
Right. When they started airing those promos, I knew that your run, your appearance was coming up, and you hadn't appeared yet. I'm like, could it be that Steven's the next Great Champion that they're promoting?
77,110,000. $2 million.
Records are meant to be broken. Is it too soon to start making comparisons with Ken Jennings?
Well, I mean, it was kind of fun to be a part of that. I was kind of Janet Leigh and Psycho. Like, I was their red herring because, like, they had my face as part of that promo where they, like, showed, like, five or six people who were going to be on that in early April in quick succession. And, you know, people, like, saw me win five games. And like, oh, my gosh, who's, you know, what's this guy? Like, is this the guy? And I'm sitting there thinking, like, well, no, I don't think they're going to air a special promo just for me. Yeah. Me and my five-game win. Like, they had already kind of run a four-game curse promo the week before. So I figured that, like, that was my big moment in the sun, that I was going to be the one to break that streak.
And a four-day total of
92,000.
Four-day total of 100. A four-day total of 87,000.
Four-day total,
100,000.
One.
A four-day total of 93,301.
But I'd gotten a little kind of, I wasn't an official part of the, like, Jeopardy community online yet, but I was certainly, like, paying more attention to folks than I normally had been. And I had seen that there were rumblings of somebody going on a, you know, a historic run. And I remembered James from my tape day, and I saw his face in that promo. And I remembered, like, I didn't stick around to watch any of his games that first week, which weren't record-setting, but were certainly very impressive. But I remembered in the green room, he had lots of questions about the buzzer, like a whole lot of questions about the buzzer, which to me either said he was very, very nervous about being on the show, or he was so confident in his knowledge that he only thought the only thing he was worried about was the buzzer. So that, like, I was able to kind of put two and two together and be like, okay, I think that this is the one, because I know it's not me. Mm-hmm. And then as far as, you know, watching him, watching his run and how it changed tournament prep, like, I had my strategy, which it wasn't the one thing that I think is kind of a flaw in the all-out daily double hunt strategy is that you might find the first daily double too soon before you have enough money to really make it valuable. If you find that, like, for example, in the game that James lost to Emma, his 33rd game, he found the first daily double on the very first clue. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe if he had, and he ended up being only a couple thousand behind Emma going into Final Jeopardy, I believe. So if he had had maybe 2,000 or 2,500 when he found that daily double, he might have had the lead going into Final. So I think that one of the things that it's important to do if you're going to employ that strategy is don't really start hunting for it until you've got at least $1,000. You do run the risk of somebody else finding it, but at that point, if you're not maximizing it for yourself, then you're still putting yourself at risk. So I was going to start hunting for the daily double eventually once I got to, like, maybe, you know, $1,500, $2,000 and see if I was able to fish it out of there. But seeing James play, you know, I think all of us knew that we were all going to have to play that style. You know, all out daily double hunt, forest bounce, you know, try to get money on the board as quickly as we could and find that daily double as quickly as we could. So that changed my strategy a little bit. Like, I was already studying to be bouncing around the board. When I had my flashcards, I would mix them all up. So I'd be going from, you know, a science question to a literature question to a U.S. president's question to a world history question to a pop culture, you know, without giving myself time to readjust. So I was ready to do that. The only thing that it really affected on me was I knew that I was going to have to, you know, start from the bottom and start looking for those daily doubles as quickly as I could. And I think that I don't think that's a strategy that can work for everybody on the show. I think that, you know, if you put, like, the 15 of us who are out there on the Tournament of Champions, I think that if you're a Tournament of Champions caliber player just playing top down, then you could probably make some hay bouncing around the board. Like, you've probably got the speed and the knowledge base and, you know, the instant recall that you could make that work. But I think that it's important for everybody to play to their strengths as best as they can. You know, watching James's run, there were some people who started trying to imitate his style who obviously weren't comfortable with it, whether because they hadn't prepared for it or his gameplay had caught them off guard or because they just didn't have the knowledge base to get those bottom row clues, you know, without kind of building up to it with the lower value clues. I think that it's important to play your game, whatever your game is. You know, I was fortunate enough that I had practiced to be bouncing around the board and playing playing from the bottom up. So I was okay going in with that style. But I don't think it's not something that I recommend to everybody. I think that, you know, you've got to be a pretty, you know, you've got to be ready for it going in. And if you practice it and you don't feel comfortable with it, I would say don't do it. If you practice it and you feel like you're able to do it, then by all means, go for it. But, you know, I was in that situation where I'd done some bouncing around in my earlier games, and I'd had 7 months to kind of prepare my mind to have to bounce around that quickly. So really the only change for me was, you know, making sure that I tried to find those daily doubles as quick as I could. Of course, I didn't end up finding any daily doubles during either of my tournament games, which, you know, shot that plan all to hell. But it, at the very least, I can say that I was prepared to do it.
Yeah. And when you say you practiced, how do you, like, what types of questions, how do you get the questions to practice?
So I made about 40,000 flashcards. It was a lot. it became practically a full-time job there as I started cramming at the end. But there's a website called JArchive, which collects literally every question that is asked on the show. They're incomplete in the earliest years of Jeopardy, but from, I think, like 2000 on, they've got 100% every clue that's ever appeared on the show.
Wow.
And, you know, and a ton of them from the 90s as well. So I was able to go in there and search, you know, for keywords or, you know, like cities or authors or scientists or books, movies, music, songs, albums, and see what did the show like to ask about that person, place, or thing. You know, what do they expect you to know about Shakespeare? Wow. What do they expect you to know about Hamlet? What do they expect you to know about The Great Gatsby or Of Mice and Men or For Whom the Bell Tolls? And, you know, do that, you know, for an extensive number of people, places, and things. So I used a flashcard app called Anki, where I would, you know, create my flashcard on my computer, upload it to this app that I had on my phone, and then I could organize it there based on categories. So I had, you know, an African history and geography category. I had an Asian and Oceania history and geography, a literature category, a philosophy category, you know, business and industry category, and so on and so on. So I would go through my flashcard decks, you know, introducing, you know, maybe 25 to 50 new flashcards a day, but spending most of my time reviewing old ones. And then once I got to the point where I knew that I knew one, I would move it out of its deck and into a deck that I called Forest Bounce Practice. So that deck ended up with, you know, a smorgasbord of clues from every different category. So that way, when I got into the time to start reviewing that deck, I wasn't going to get five or six questions about, you know, Brazil in a row. I was going to get a question about Brazil and then a question about John Steinbeck and then a question about, you know, Romania, a question about soufflés. And it was just going to go back and forth and back and forth. So that way I wasn't training myself just to get in, you know, an Asian history and geography mode. I was training myself to be ready to, at a moment's notice, go from one type of category to the next, to the next, to the next. And after doing that for 7 months, I was pretty comfortable that I wasn't going to get thrown off by bouncing from one category to the next. I was going to be able to change gears just as quick as we could change categories.
Yeah. Wow. A lot of preparation.
Oh, it sure was. I wish I had more time.
As much as you did.
You know, everybody's got their own style. You know, we were kind of comparing notes back there in the green room, just like, hey, how did you do it? You know, did you use handwritten flashcards? Did you use computerized ones? You know, we had someone in the room who was has a master's or a PhD in like educational psychology and development. So she had her own strategy. We had other people who were just kind of making notes like they used to back in college or high school. I had actually seen during the All-Star Games, Ken Jennings was using this flashcard app in one of his kind of behind-the-scenes vignettes that they did for those. So I figured if it was good enough for Ken Jennings, it would be good enough for me. Mm-hmm. So that was the way that I ended up doing it. But yeah, like everybody's got their own style. There's really no one-size-fits-all for that. There's no one-size-fits-all for anything on Jeopardy.
No.
There's no one-size-fits-all studying method. There's no one-size-fits-all buzzer strategy. There's no one-size-fits-all clue selection strategy. You just have to cater it to what fits you the best. And I knew that, you know, just reading like a big reference book or a textbook wasn't really going to allow me to get this sheer number of facts that I needed to stuck in my head. So I figured that like breaking them down to their simplest form, just, you know, flashcards, like, you know, three or four words, a sentence at most, and just kind of drilling it into my head over and over and over until I was comfortable with it was the way that I needed to go.
Wow.
And it worked. I mean, I in my training, I saw a huge, huge improvement over the course of my studying for the tournament. I mean, my biggest regret is that I didn't study this way the first time around, because I know that I would have made more money. I know that I would have won more than five games. You know,
and you might have, I mean, who knows, the next great champion.
Yeah, exactly. Like maybe I would have knocked James off in his first game. I mean, I don't know, because I didn't put in the work. So that's the one big regret that I have to live with, is that I didn't take it seriously enough the first time around. And I know that as well as I did, that I still could have done better. And with getting, you know, being fortunate enough to be invited back for the tournament, I knew that I wanted to give studying my all, just, you know, whether I won or whether I, you know, finished in the negatives in the quarterfinals, whatever I did, I wanted to know that I prepared as best as I could.
Yeah. But you still have to think about, like, you can't drive yourself crazy. Look how well you did.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's,
yeah,
that is very true. And that's kind of something I've been working on, is that, you know, don't look at what you didn't do. Look at what you did do. Like, yeah. I won five games. I made it to the
tournament. I know.
That's like, that was my biggest goal when I went out there. Like, I wrote down a list of goals as soon as they called me to tell me I was going to be on the show. And the biggest goal that I wrote down was win five games and make it to the Tournament of Champions. Yeah. And I did that. Like, I did everything that I set out to do. So, like, I can always look back and think, what if? But I don't have, you know, that's not something to lose sleep over. Like, I got a nice sized check in the mail from them.
Yes.
That'll help me sleep well at night.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff, we should probably wrap things up, because it's getting long.
Yeah, I was thinking that as well. So we'll go ahead and wrap it up. I'll give you, Aunt Beth and you, Stephen, if either of you have anything you'd like to promote, you can go ahead.
I'm just excited for the – so is it January 7th is the next tournament with Ken and James and what's the other guy?
Brad.
That should be fun.
Yeah, that'll be on prime time on ABC starting January 7th.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. But no, I don't have anything else for me to promote.
Stephen, you have anything you'd like to throw out there?
Yeah, I do, and it goes back to something that Beth mentioned earlier on. Kind of in the wake of Alex's pancreatic cancer diagnosis and the fact that Larry Martin, who was the 2018 Teachers Tournament champion on Jeopardy, he was going to be in this Tournament of Champions, but he passed away from pancreatic cancer earlier this year. And following, you know, Drew's We Love You, Alex answer, all of us in the Tournament of Champions, we had been wearing purple ribbons during the taping in honor of Alex and Larry. And mm-hmm. we all wanted to try and organize a fundraiser for pancreatic cancer research in their honor. So we've been working with the Lust Garden Foundation for pancreatic cancer research. And they've actually put on a Jeopardy-specific fundraiser where you can we're encouraging folks to watch an episode of the show, tally the number of correct answers that they give, and donate $1 for each correct answer to the Lust Garden Foundation. Their website is Lustgarten, LustGarten.org. There's more information about it pinned on my Twitter feed, which is at ask_Steven, STEVEN. So for anybody listening, if you're a Jeopardy fan, if you're an Alex Trebek fan, if you've seen the SNL Celebrity Jeopardy parodies, whatever the case may be, we're encouraging you to watch the show, play along at home, and donate $1 to the Lustgarten Foundation in honor of Alex and in memory of Larry.
Fantastic.
All right. I played along during the Tournament of Champions, and I think I'm going to play along again during the Greatest of All Time tournament.
Yeah, the Jeopardy specific one is going to be up through the Greatest of All Time tournament. We were very excited to learn about that. The only one of us who knew what was happening was James, and he kept a mum about that one. But I've been working closely with the folks at the foundation, and they've agreed to keep it open through the GOAT tournament, just in case folks are watching, and we catch fire again. I mean, you know, Dhruv was on Ellen. We've raised, his answer in the fundraiser. We've raised almost $70,000 through it already.
Wow.
So we're looking, hoping that we can get another big boost here, kind of on the heels of the Greatest of All Time tournament, and hopefully raise enough money that we can make a little bit of a difference.
Will they announce it on that? Like, how do people hear about it besides, I mean, you just announced it on this, but.
Yeah. The Jeopardy social media folks have been great about helping us to promote it.
Okay.
They put information about it on their Twitter feed, on their Facebook page. And then also, you know, when Dhruv's final Jeopardy response went so viral, it got a lot of eyes on us. So, us in the tournament, we were just looking at, you know, looking through the hashtags and looking through the Twitter mentions of folks talking about Alex or folks tweeting, "We love you, Alex." And you know, for any celebrities, any journalists, any, you know, people with large Twitter followings, companies, corporations, you know, news outlets. I ended up doing an interview with a local affiliate in Minneapolis, Minnesota, because they tweeted about it and I tweeted at them and they asked me on to talk about it. So just anybody who had any kind of a following who was, you know, showed that they were interested in Jeopardy, you know, folks who had been on the show before for Celebrity Jeopardy or introducing categories or the subjects of Clues, we got in touch with them. We said, "Hey, like, will you just please help us amplify this and see, you know, see if you shoot your shot?" And we got some pretty big names, you know, that were out there kind of helping us spread the word. But even people I'd never heard of who have, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 Twitter followers, they were like, "Absolutely, I love Jeopardy. Like, Alex is a hero of mine. Let me see if I can help you spread it." And, you know, it's been enough to raise $70,000 here so far.
Perfect.
Just through, you know, small donations. You know, the Ellen Show chipped in $25,000 and James chipped in $8,000 on his own. But that leaves another, you know, $35,000, $37,000 that were just people donating, you know, $20, $30, $40. Like, kind of that grassroots thing that it was wonderful to see and to be a part of all that. I mean, it was the most gratifying part of the whole tournament experience, honestly. Just, you know, I've kind of found this accidental calling that I never knew that I had, but now I'm in touch with the folks at the foundation on a regular basis, and we're trying to, you know, brainstorm new ways that we can raise more funds for them. And it's been just an unexpected pleasure and privilege to be able to get to do this work with them.
I'll bet it is.
I'll make sure to add a note about Lustgarten in the episode description.
Thank you very much.
And I'll quickly promote my stuff. You can read my thoughts on entertainment in general on my blog, jmoney.com. That's jmoney spelled JMUNNEY. And you can also follow me on Twitter at jmoneymalone. And please follow That's Entertainment on social media. We're at Entertainment on Twitter, and that's at Entertainment on Instagram and Facebook. And please rate, review, and subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you listen on. If Aunt Beth, I think we can go ahead and make this promise that if you do write a review, we will read it on air.
Okay.
if you're the type of person who'd love to hear your thoughts read on a podcast, go ahead and give us a review.
That's a good idea.
And yeah, and what's that?
I just said that's a good idea.
For all you Jeopardy fans out there, we already mentioned the Greatest of All Time tournament. And the show airs regularly Monday through Fridays. It's syndicated, so it depends on where you live. So check Jeopardy.com. That should tell you if you don't know already. Steven mentioned that in the Atlanta area, it airs at 7:30. And I believe that's the same in the Bangor, Maine area.
Yes.
For UAMP. Is it on ABC in Atlanta?
It is on NBC here.
Okay.
The Jeopardy website has a page where you can type in your zip code and they'll show you your network in time. So Jeopardy.com and look for that tab.
Yes, exactly. And there are also a selection of classic episodes currently up on Netflix and Hulu.
The Buzzy Cohen collection.
Yeah, that one's his original run is currently up there. So if he was a favorite of yours or someone you love to hate, you can get one.
Buzzy, if you're listening, I love you.
Those feelings again. Buzzy, if you're listening, I love you too. And I think part of my affection for you is how much you resemble the skinny lawyer from The Simpsons.
I will be sure to tell him that you said that.
Awesome. And Beth, I know we've been trying to work on a sign-off for you. Have you thought of anything?
Oh, geez, I still haven't. I was just going to say, what is good night?
that sounds like a good one for now.
For tonight. Maybe, yeah. Well, maybe we'll use it again because, I mean, we all love Jeopardy so much, I can imagine we might want to do a second episode about it.
Hey, if you do, you know who to call.
Yeah.
Yes, we do. We can call you and we can maybe we can get your entire text chain to contribute.
Oh, I'm sure they would love it. They are always happy to chat.
Good to hear. All right. Well, till next time. This has been another episode of That's Entertainment. And so, in summation, keep your remote handy and your eyes open.